In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the October issue of EmedHome's EMCast. This is Amol Mattu from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Well, this month we've got three great topics to go through and discuss. We're going to kick things off with a discussion on acute coronary syndrome in women. And joining me for this discussion is first-time discussant Dr. Susie DeMeester. Susie is a faculty member up in Michigan, a former member of our residency program, graduated back in 2000, I won't say how long ago it was, but she's been doing really great things in the community. She's been publishing on a number of things, and her niche is ACS in women. And there is a couple of really nice articles that were recently published on this topic, and Susie's going to go through the best of those and educate us about why we are so often screwing up in terms of our diagnosis and management of women when they have ACS. Secondly, we're going to spend some time talking with Dr. Rupal Jain. Rupal was here last month talking about some risk management topics, and she's going to be back talking about some more risk management, specifically with regards to communication and documentation. And then we're going to wrap things up by speaking with Dr. Priya Kupusamy, who's going to be talking about some risk management issues with regards to aortic dissection, one of the needles in the haystack that we all come to fear. So we've got three incredibly bright women who are going to be talking to us about some high-risk conditions and some good risk management. Before we jump in, I just want to remind everybody about an upcoming fantastic conference, speaking of risk management, on October 14th, which is Wednesday, our 10th annual Crashing Patient Conference. The formal title of this conference is The Crashing Patient Risk Management and Resuscitation. We're going to be spending some time talking about high-risk topics. Of course, because of COVID-19, this is the first year that we're not going to be in person, but we're going to be doing the whole thing via live stream. So if you're interested in watching it or getting access to it afterwards, check out the website www.thecrashingpatient.com. This usually gets about 200 attendees from all around the world, and a few thousand people watch it afterwards. And I think because it's going to be conveniently placed on Zoom and recorded, we'll probably get even more than that. So check out the topics. Short, sweet, really great, and clinically useful topics. www.thecrashingpatient.com. All right, let's now get on to the October issue of EmedHome's EMCast. All right. Well, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we're going to kick things off this month by talking about an article that was published in a European Heart Journal on a topic which is continually a really, really hot topic. And this has to do with acute coronary syndrome in women. And joining me is Dr. Susie DeMeester. Susie is a faculty member at University of Michigan, and also primarily works at St. Joseph's Mercy Hospital, where the residents from University of Michigan rotate. And she's got a lot of community clinical experience and teaching experience. And also, I just want to put a plug in for some of Susie's lectures. She lectured at our cardiology symposium a couple of years ago, I guess, Susie, and also at AAM. And she's starting to make her way into the speaking circuit. It's just an outstanding speaker. And one of her main areas of interest is, well, her general area of interest, I guess, is emergency cardiology, but she's developed kind of a niche in this particular topic, women and ACS, which again is just such an important and hot topic. So first of all, Susie, welcome to EMCast. I don't recall if you've been on this before.
Thanks so much for having me, Amol. No, this is my first time.
All right. Well, great. Well, this is, I guess, if there's even a little positivity about the pandemic, it's forced us to start doing some of these EMCast recordings remotely. And so even though you're in Michigan, we can get together like this. Anyway, let's get into this. Susie, it seems every year there's at least a half dozen articles that get published that talk about ACS in women And it seems to me that despite all of this literature, there's still a lack of understanding of the fact that we, meaning emergency medicine, internal medicine, cardiology, everybody, need to think differently about ACS and cardiac disease in women. But this article provides a really nice review of many of the reasons why, in many senses, women's hearts and coronaries are different than what we've typically learned. Let's go ahead and get into this. The authors start out with a discussion of the biological differences of the coronaries. Can you take us through that?
Thanks again, Amal, for having me. And you know I love this topic. I did think this article did a nice job of reviewing some of the differences and barriers that are associated with the diagnosis and care of women with ACS. Because despite increased awareness of atypical symptoms with things like the Red Dress campaign, heart disease unfortunately remains the number one killer of women in the United States. And what's really disturbing is this continued trend of rising morbidity and mortality in young women in contrast to a decrease in younger men. But back to your question regarding biological differences. So in emergency medicine, by now, I think we all realize that women present differently than their male counterparts. But it's also important to realize that there are physiologic differences in cardiac and coronary anatomy. So first, women have smaller diameter coronaries. Important to keep this in mind when you're looking at an EKG, because you're likely going to see smaller degrees of ST segment elevation. And when we're talking about enzymes, troponin levels are going to be lower, and hence the need for things like sex-specific cutoffs. Women also have a higher baseline myocardial blood flow. And so this combination of smaller coronaries and high blood flow leads to increased shear stress and plaque instability. While ACS in men is usually the result of thrombotic plaque occlusion, ACS in women often results from something known as plaque erosion. And so what happens is you have gradual wearing down of the endothelium. And so you have obstruction that's caused by microemboli that travel into the arterioles that travel downstream. Plaque erosion is actually thought to be responsible for about 30% of STEMIs and 30% of NSTEMIs, meaning these patients are going to have a clean cath. This is a recurrent theme when we're talking about ACS in women. Estrogen also plays a role with endothelial and vascular integrity. Decreased estrogen leads to increased vascular stiffness and decreased compliance. And so this contributes to increased cardiovascular risk in postmenopausal women. Women are also at significant risk of something known as non-occlusive ACS. This is definitely, from an EM perspective, way less glamorous than those STEMIs or other type 1 MIs we all get excited about. Non-occlusive ACS, when we're talking about women, encompasses things like microvascular ischemia. This means you have ischemia of arterioles, so not your coronaries. And so again, you're not going to find this on PCI. Plaque erosion, as I talked about before, can contribute to this disease process. And then it's important to think of things like SCAD, spontaneous coronary artery dissection, and Takotsubos. Both are examples of non-occlusive ACS.
So let me just highlight a couple of key points. You had mentioned that women have smaller degrees of ST elevation. And as we know, the EKG machine is not going to call it ischemia or a true STEMI unless it's a full millimeter or so. So I guess we're more likely to get non-STEMI diagnoses in women. And so that might decrease the number of these patients that immediately go to the cath lab. Is that kind of what might end up happening with these patients, Susie?
Yeah, exactly, Amal. And I also think that there's probably a propensity to miss these smaller degrees of ST segment elevation because they're not going to jump out at us. And especially in those inferior leads, which are really sometimes difficult to identify, that's where I would be focusing.
Right. I really appreciate your discussion of the plaque erosion because honestly, I've heard about this minimally invasive coronary disease in women, and I've never really truly understood the reason for it until just now. So this smaller diameter coronaries with increase in blood flow, putting more stress on the coronaries. So that kind of makes sense finally. I don't know how many people out there have been hearing about the minimally invasive coronary disease, but it kind of makes sense now. So, in terms of the diagnosis for this non-occlusive or minimally invasive type of disease. How does the diagnosis for this process differ from that of the traditional big ST elevation type 1 STEMI?
So we really focus a lot of our attention when we're talking about ACS in the ED on moving that patient to the cath lab, right? Getting them out of the emergency department. But for women, this may not be diagnostic or therapeutic because, again, up to 30% of women with ACS are going to have that label of having a clean cath. So cath is actually useful, though, to rule out occlusive disease, but it's not going to identify all causes of non-occlusive ACS. Certainly, when we're talking about Takotsubos, you can use angiography in conjunction with a ventriculogram, and you can diagnose spontaneous coronary artery dissection in the cath lab, but the caveat is that the intervention can lead to dissection propagation and increase morbidity. But when you're talking microvascular ischemia, remember, coronaries are going to be clean, and so you really need a high index of suspicion to move towards that diagnosis. These are your patients who bounce back, who keep coming back in with worrisome symptoms, troponin bumps, but have a clean cath. And they unfortunately often end up with this diagnosis of non-cardiac chest pain. These patients can be really frustrating to us, and they are often frustrated themselves. So no, you're not going to make the diagnosis of microvascular ischemia in the ED. But these patients need to be given the benefit of the doubt and referred either back to their cardiologist or to a center that specializes in microvascular coronary disease.
So the history, again, for all the young folks out there that really rely a lot on technology, history still really, really does make a difference. In terms of the risk factors, we've all learned about the classic Framingham risk factors. Are those still applicable to women, or are there any other risk factors we need to know about for women?
So yes, the traditional risk factors are the same for women and men. But two, smoking and diabetes appear to have a stronger impact on women. Risk factors in general are tied really closely to cardiovascular disease, but especially in younger women. Meaning a younger patient with risk factors, I'm going to be very concerned about ACS. Whereas a younger patient without any risk factors, I'm much less worried. Also, what I found really interesting is that women under the age of 65 who have a maternal history of MI have a 4 times higher risk of ACS than same-aged men or older women. So I'm definitely adding that question to my family history inventory. And then there's some other non-traditional risk factors we should be aware of when we're considering ACS in women. Stress, things like depression, lower socioeconomic status, trauma, really any stress is considered a significant risk factor. And again, this theme, especially in younger and middle-aged women. And then lastly, going back to the idea that estrogen is protective, menopause and postmenopausal periods are additional risk factors you need to consider.
Right. And we've actually, I think last year, maybe it was last year there, or maybe the year before, there was an article in Circulation that talked about the fact that one of the more common misdiagnoses in women is stress. There's this tendency for all of us to just, you know, say, ah, oh, Ms. Jones, she was having some chest pain when she was involved in an argument. It's just stress. Give her some benzos. And we tend to miss STEMIs in patients that are having stress. So that's really interesting. And then what can be more possibly stressful than the pandemic that we're all involved in, right? There's some studies that have been recently published that have talked about increased rates of depression and suicide during the past few months of this pandemic. And I'm curious to find out whether maybe in the coming months they're going to discover an increased risk of stress-related MIs as well. Now, you talked a little bit about maternal history of MI, which kind of leads us to the next question. What role does pregnancy play in ACS and in terms of your risk factor assessment? Aside from, have you had a previous MI during pregnancy? What if the patient is pregnant?
Well, so pregnancy is really, it's basically a 9-month stress test. And I really liked a line in this article that articulated that pregnancy is a glimpse into a woman's future health status, meaning there are certain conditions in pregnancy that indicate future cardiovascular risk. So things like preeclampsia, abruption, gestational hypertension, and diabetes, you may want to consider asking these things when you are doing your risk factor inventory. And also beyond the scope of this discussion, remember that pregnant patients are also at risk for spontaneous coronary artery dissection and also peripartum cardiomyopathy.
Great. So now a lot of the literature that we've seen in recent years has talked about the differences in terms of presentations, different signs or symptoms that women have compared to men. Can you take us through that? What type of signs and symptoms do women have that might throw us off or be different?
Sure. So while chest pain is still going to be present for the majority of women, women and especially elderly women are more likely to present with those atypical symptoms. And I actually think it's funny that we still call these symptoms, which can happen in 50% of the population, atypical. Because for women, these non-chest pain symptoms are really the norm. So dyspnea is going to be your most common anginal equivalent, especially in elderly women. But things like weakness and nausea, left arm pain, back pain, jaw pain, these are all going to be more common in women. It's also been reported that women can report days or weeks of prodromal symptoms that include things like anxiety and sleep disturbances.
So speaking of anxiety, the authors did spend quite a bit of time in the article talking about anxiety and mental stress. And you mentioned that earlier. Can you take us through that section?
So yes, I briefly talked about this when we were talking about risk factors, but yes, stress, physical or mental, is a uniquely strong risk factor when we're talking about ACS. And again, in young women especially. We know that Takotsubo's is classically triggered by stress, but stress is also tied closely to the other types of acute coronary syndrome. And even on the recovery side, we know that depression is common in patients post-ACS, but it appears that women suffering from MI experience higher degrees of psychological stress and depression, both of which are tied to worse prognosis and recovery.
Now, a lot of questions that come up have to do with the workup, and specifically a lot of questions that I've heard in the past have to do with, say, the heart score. Since women present atypically, does the heart score or other risk stratification type of scores, do those work with women? Can you talk to us a little bit about the diagnostic process of ACS in women? And what do you do? How do you use any of these scores with women?
Let me start by saying I am a heart score proponent. I've studied it, I use it, but how well does it work for women? With atypical symptoms, as you mentioned, I do worry that the history portion is going to be underscored. And the score doesn't include those additional risk factors we talked about earlier. And as this article points out, the absence of chest discomfort and younger age, these are the two strongest predictors of a misdiagnosis of ACS. And this makes me a little worried that the heart score may just not work that well for women. However, what's interesting is that in a 2017 observational study that was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, the investigators actually found that early discharge of women with low heart scores was safer than with men. In fact, 6-week MACE rates were 2 times lower in women than in men. And I think the reason the heart score may actually still work really well for women is that young women without risk factors are probably going to have low heart scores and so are really low risk. And so it's those young women with risk factors that I really worry about.
So you do use the heart score with women?
I do use the heart score. I will say that it's not been validated to assign points for additional risk factors, but it's something that I have done. So some of those non-traditional risk factors I have given my female patients actual points for.
Sure, sure. And we do that also with other risk factors that have been identified as independent risk factors, for example, HIV and chronic cocaine use and a couple other things like that. Yeah, I think you're not limited to only using the classic Framingham risk factors. So it, with this knowledge in mind, it totally makes sense to consider these other risk factors. And I guess knowing the atypicality of these patients, you know, the H in the heart score allows for a little subjectivity. And so I guess you can apply that subjectivity there as well. Lastly, let's get into management a little bit. What type of differences are there between men and women in the area of management of ACS once you've suspected the diagnosis or you confirm the diagnosis?
So unfortunately, lots of problems for women here. There is a huge underrepresentation of women in cardiovascular studies, and so much of the treatment data is extrapolated. And again, while our focus in the treatment of ACS is typically on getting that patient to the cath lab, women with these non-occlusive disease processes are not going to benefit from this approach. Women have been found to have worse short-term outcomes after ACS than men, which you can partially attribute to older age and maybe associated comorbidities, but it's also likely a result of things like delays in presentation, diagnosis, and treatment. And while outcome measures for STEMI, they seem to be equal between the two sexes, women with NSTEMI are less likely to be taken to the cath lab. And there's many reasons, but again, can include these atypical symptoms. It's very difficult to monitor, let's say, the degree of a patient's dyspnea as compared to chest pain if you're using something like a symptom-guided approach. And then also frequently cited is this increased bleeding risk associated with PCI. This bleeding risk is usually, unfortunately, tied to incorrect dosing. In terms of medications, with the exception of aspirin, women are less likely to receive heparin and all other anticoagulants, even for STEMI. And then after ACS, women are less likely to be discharged on appropriate medications, including things like beta blockers, statins, and ACE inhibitors.
You know, it's really interesting to me that this literature has continued to come out for like 20 years, and yet we still keep hearing about the studies saying that women tend to be undertreated, even with all of the evidence-based therapies. They get undertreated for PCIs and what else did you say? Beta blockers, statins, ACE inhibitors. And I've even seen, maybe not really recent, but some slightly older studies, 5-10 years ago, saying that women were less likely to even get aspirin. And it just, it confuses me about why that would still be the case. I guess there's still that perception that's really prevalent out there that women, especially premenopausal women, just don't get ACS. That's what I learned in med school. And maybe that belief is still out there. So it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I think, again, it's these two groups. I think it's the younger patients and then also the elderly patients who have the atypical symptoms. And I think it takes us through a different cognitive process to really be able to understand how to treat patients who aren't presenting with chest pain, who aren't clutching their chest.
Yeah. Well, studies like this and discussions like this hopefully will continue to get word out about this. Well, that was a really great discussion. This article, I should have probably put the reference in at the beginning, but this article from European Heart Journal, first author is Ahmed Haider, and the title of this article, Sex and Gender in Cardiovascular Medicine, Presentation and Outcomes of Acute Coronary Syndrome. This was a really, really great article, really thorough, and it was really dense. I don't know if that was your impression also, but there's a lot of stuff in here. And I think you did a fantastic job of summarizing this down to the really key points over the past 20, 25 minutes or so. But for the people that want to learn a lot more about this, again, this is a great article to pull and go through some of the details in here. But let's kind of bring things home, and let me ask you, are there some really absolutely key take-home points that you'd like to leave the listeners with as we sign off?
Key points. Sex differences in ACS exist both in presentation, but also in physiology and pathophysiology. It's important to recognize that there are additional risk factors in women, and these young women with risk factors are the highest risk. So obtain those EKGs liberally and look at them closely. Consider non-occlusive ACS because it's going to be a common cause of ACS in women, and these patients are not going to be treated in the cath lab. And lastly, follow guideline-based treatment recommendations for all of your patients with ACS.
All right, Susie, awesome job. Well, thanks so much for taking us through this, and hopefully we'll be able to get you back on EMCast for some more good discussions of emergency cardiology. Until then, please stay safe and best wishes going through the fall in terms of the flu and the pandemic and everything else like that. Take care. All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we're going to spend a little time talking about some risk management. There is a really great article on communication and documentation that was published in Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America, an issue that was entirely devoted to risk management topics in the May 2020 issue.
and we're going to talk about this very, very important topic. Joining me is one of our affiliate faculty, Dr. Rupal Jain. Rupal's been on the podcast a couple of times before. You may remember Rupal finished our residency, and then she did a faculty development fellowship. She did ASEP's teaching fellowship, and she has continued to do some teaching within our residency program. She now works at one of our affiliate hospitals, Prince George's County Hospital, which is really high volume, high acuity. And so, Rupal, thanks for taking time from your busy clinical practice to join us to go through this. Rupal actually discussed this topic in our residency conference just last month, I guess. And there was a lot of really great pearls that she dropped on everyone. And so I wanted to get her to talk about some of this information for EMCast. So once again, Rupal, welcome back. We'll kind of start things off a little bit. They spend a bit more time talking about documentation. And they talk about the fact that documentation and communication has four purposes: communicating clinical data to downstream providers, supporting reimbursement, ensuring that care complies with hospital and regulatory policies, and fourth, shielding providers from malpractice risk. And this fourth topic, this fourth purpose, is really what we're going to focus a bit more on. So first of all, let's talk about communication. The authors list a couple of types of communication as they relate to risk management. The first is communication with patients and family members. So Rupal, can you take us through the key points of this section of that article?
Of course. Well, outside of work, we know that good communication is the hallmark of great relationships. And if we value our patients and their family members, then why would it be any different at work? It's in my opinion that as emergency physicians and team leaders, we have to strive for excellence, especially in the provider-patient communication. Now, this means that we take the time to not only answer the patient's questions, but we pause to solicit questions from patients before we walk out of the room. We read their facial expressions and body language and take the opportunity to allay their fears. We enable trust, and we include patients in their care by performing shared decision-making when possible. Now, you might be asking, why even do all of this, as we know it takes more time? Well, good communication improves patient satisfaction. And believe it or not, compared with physicians in the top third of patient satisfaction scores, those in the middle third had a 26% higher rate of malpractice suits, and those in the lower third had a 110% higher rate. So this must mean, I guess, that it pays to be a good communicator and a liked physician.
And you pay out if you're not a good communicator, I guess.
Exactly. So
that's, yeah, that's very, very true. And you know, we've talked about this before, that patients oftentimes sue not just because bad things happen, but because they're unhappy about something. And if patients are happy with their doctor, if they had good rapport, good communication skills, oftentimes they're much more willing to accept that their doctors are human and sometimes will make mistakes, which we all do. So the authors, since we're talking about mistakes, actually, the authors next discuss disclosing errors, which is a really uncomfortable and difficult thing to do. I have to say that back when I was in residency, this was something that we never talked about. This whole concept of disclosing errors was just not at all talked about. It was not necessarily discouraged, but no one ever talked about this concept of, you know, a little mistake was made, you should go and talk to your patient about it. But it has become a very big part of common teaching nowadays. So how does disclosing errors relate to risk management? Doesn't it increase your risk when you tell your patients that a mistake was made?
My tongue-in-cheek response is just don't make any errors. But I'm only kidding.
We're not as good as you, Rupal. So what do the rest of us do?
I'm only kidding. To err is human. And unfortunately, while some errors feel like they're avoidable, all errors cannot be avoided. So if you or the care team have made an error, know that some studies actually prove the opposite of what you said. Physicians disclosing errors can lead to actually a 40% relative risk reduction in malpractice lawsuits. Now, take that, though, with a grain of salt. Other studies actually demonstrate that routinely disclosing errors may actually increase your risk exposure. So it's best to do so in consultation with your risk management department, especially if the error caused the patient harm. Remember that errors that occur that do not cause harm to patients are historically rarely successful. So especially in the situation in which an error has occurred that did not cause harm, it may be advisable to disclose the error. The article provided some really quick tips on how to best do this. So first is to disclose the error before the patient or the family member discovers the error. Second is to explicitly state that an error has occurred. Then describe the error in a clear and concise language. Remember, clarity is kindness. So next, explain potential harms, even if unlikely. Express regret without admission of fault, and explain the steps that will be taken to prevent recurrences.
Okay, so those are the four steps. Disclose before the patient and family discover the error. Number two, be clear about what the error was. Number three, explain potential harms. And number four, I like number four, talking to them about what you and I guess the department are going to do to prevent further mistakes like that or errors from happening also. So the question oftentimes comes up about issuing an apology. Should you actually apologize to them about the error? How does that work out?
Yeah. So, you know, those magic words, I'm sorry. Well, they might not exactly be advised, especially when it goes along with admission of fault. Definitely don't apologize if you're practicing in states like Alabama, Arkansas, Kansas, Kentucky, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Jersey, where apologies can actually still be used against medical professionals in court. And in the 40 other states where apologies should not be used against medical professionals in court, recognize that there are still many technicalities and it's probably still the safest to actually make a sincere apology without implications of fault.
Okay, so I guess it's worth expressing some regret that something happened, but don't take the responsibility on yourself necessarily or apologize unless you are, I guess, I suppose it makes sense to discuss all of this with your particular risk managers based on your hospital policies and based on your state laws.
I think that's the best advice I could give.
Okay. Well, the authors discussed three high-risk areas in terms of communication and documentation, and I think this is really getting into the meat of this article. The first thing that they talk about is handoffs and transitions of care. What do they say about this?
So I love that the article mentions another study which states that handoffs are considered the most dangerous procedure in the emergency department. According to this article, communication breakdowns are cited in about 80% of malpractice claims, with those occurring at sign-out involved in about 24% of malpractice claims. So I guess the solution is to just work continuously and never leave the emergency department to avoid sign-out. Now, if that's
never sign out your patients, just stay there until your patient goes upstairs. That might be days at a time.
Exactly. And I guess if that's not feasible, pay attention to these few tips. So first is to develop a standard approach amongst your group. Script this conversation so as not to leave out any important information. So the second advice I'll give is to headline the sign out with a succinct overview of the patient to provide the oncoming physician with a framework in which to organize the details. So for example, this is an active patient for you, a 23-year-old woman whose disposition is pending a CT of the abdomen pelvis and reassessment of pain. Or this is an admitted 72-year-old woman who was admitted to MedSurg Tele for ACS evaluation. The sign out should also include if-then statements. So anticipate the results and communicate a clear plan for dealing with them. For example, if the CT scan is positive, consult her surgeon directly who performed the operation 8 days ago. If negative and she tolerates PO, I think you can discharge her.
I was going to say, I like the if-then statement. One of my most frustrating sign-outs is to sign out, I'm not really sure what's going on, so we're getting a CAT scan, and after the CAT scan is done, see what you think. I hate that. So, unfortunately, that doesn't happen too often because we now have these scripted sign-outs. But in years past, that was one of my pet peeves at sign-out time. Sorry, I had to vent. Go ahead.
No, I totally agree. Actually, speaking of pet peeves, one of my greatest pet peeves is the number of interruptions that seem to occur, of course, at the time that you're signing out. So the advice I would give is to try to move to a more quiet location to limit the number of interruptions. Or if you can, maybe just put up a sign that says, we're signing out. Interrupt only if necessary.
I like that also. Well, one of the things that we've done is we now do the, as you know, we now do walking sign out. And so rather than sitting in the docs area talking, we actually get up and we walk from room to room. And I think in many respects, when we do that, the nurses and techs and everyone else know we're signing out. And so the number of interruptions markedly decreases. Whereas back when we would just sit in the room and do sign out, it was constant interruption. So I think that's really one of the benefits that's turned out of the walking sign out.
Yeah, there's definitely many pros and cons to the walk round sign out format. Remember always that giving a good sign out is important, but so is receiving a good sign out. So if the sign out falls short, ask for clarification or more details if necessary. And if necessary, go to the patient's bedside together.
That's a great tip. I think the walking rounds that we initiated, I don't know, maybe a couple years ago has really, I think, worked out quite nicely. At first, there was a lot of resistance, including from me, some resistance about whether it's really necessary. But I think there have been quite a few benefits. And also just being able to see the patient and not just hear about the patient makes a big difference. Even if you see the patient from the doorway, just looking at them, you can kind of get a sense about whether they're really sick. You have a chance to look at the monitor, find out if they're tachycardic or hypertensive or whatever. So there's really a lot of benefit to doing that.
Yeah, I totally agree. The last piece of advice is actually related to post-sign out. Avoid ambiguous transitions. As emergency physicians, we often remain in the department and continue to care for the patient after sign out, which only confuses ancillary staff, nurses, and the oncoming provider. So basically, leave the emergency department as soon as possible after sign out.
And sign out and get the heck out.
Yeah. And if someone comes to you about the patient, and as tempting as it may be to continue to manage the patient, since you feel that you know them the best, refer that person to the oncoming provider who you've already adequately signed out to.
I like that. Sign out and get the heck out. All right. All right. Good. Well, the next area, the next high-risk area they talk about is discharge and follow-up, which you've talked a bit about in the past. But can you take us through what these authors had to say in this section?
Absolutely. Pearls and pitfalls of the discharge process is a topic I've covered on the December episode of EMCast, but I think it's so important we should absolutely discuss this again. So we've got to keep in mind that we discharge the strong majority of patients coming to the ED. And now that we're much more savvy, we're discharging patients that were traditionally much higher risk, such as those with non-massive PE and those with neutropenic fever, for example. So we've got to master the communication piece that goes along with kissing these patients goodbye. So first, go to the bedside, review their vital signs, and ideally jot these down so that you can record them in the documentation yourself. Ask the patient about their comfort level of being discharged and ask them if they anticipate any barriers to being discharged. And number two is, knowing you, you're going to type up beautifully personalized discharge instructions, but know that that's not enough. Providing these instructions verbally and personally yourself sitting down with these patients and checking for their understanding is tantamount to a successful, safe discharge. Even when your written discharge instructions are lacking, case law has shown that verbal instructions can supplement deficient written instructions in court.
All right, good.
Third, when you go back to your seat to type up or dictate those discharge instructions, remember that these instructions should be written at the level of a fifth grader. Be clear, include a summary of the findings in the emergency department and suspected diagnosis. Include instructions of when and with whom the patient should follow up. Tell them what they should do at home in the meantime. For example, what to take for pain, what prescriptions to begin. And be specific about what should raise concern, prompting them to return to the emergency department. But also be open-ended by providing a general statement to return if their symptoms worsen or if they have any problems or concerns.
All right, great.
Fourth, please review the vital signs and laboratory and radiology reports once you're discharging the patient in order to address any incidental findings, such as elevated blood pressure or an incidental finding of an asymptomatic AAA, so that the patient can follow up with their primary care physician. And lastly, remember to include computerized, standardized discharge instructions, if they exist, for common conditions, as these can be protective in malpractice suits. Review these when possible, edit them, or individualize them to the patients as well.
All right. Well, fantastic. So recapping real quick, go to the bedside, make sure the patient's comfortable with the discharge, and you ask about any barriers to sign out. Do they have a ride home, for example? Second, do verbal and the written discharge instructions. So I think that verbal part is really important and something that we are often very lazy about doing. Third, level of the fifth grader in terms of the write-up and be very specific about when, where, and with whom to follow up. Fourth, review the vital signs labs and the x-rays and CAT scans. And last time in December, I remember you talking about those the little hidden incidental lomas that show up in a lot of those radiology reports that you're going to be on the hook for. So make sure you read those reports and tell the patient what to follow up for. And then fifth, include the standardized discharge instructions. I love that. So fantastic. The third high-risk area they talk about is consultations. What are the risks associated with the consultants that we work with?
Yeah, so in general, I am abundantly grateful for our consultants that make decision-making in the emergency department so much easier in the emergency department as they offer their expertise. But consultations, however, have also been cited in about one-third of malpractice claims, and therefore, this points to the importance of good communication with our consultants in order to reduce our malpractice risk. Now, I'm usually not a fan of mnemonics, but I think that this one really works. The article mentions the five C's of the consultation techniques. The first C is contact, introducing yourself and building a relationship with the consultant. The second C is communication, concise patient presentation, keyword being concise. Let the consultant know the patient's MRN, date of birth, location in the emergency department, and provide the critical information about the patient's presentation that they need to know. The third C is core question. This is the most important. Articulate the specific question the consultant is being asked. Number four, collaboration. Ask if there's anything you can do to help the consultant answer the core question. For example, can I order you any additional labs or imaging? The fifth C is closing the loop. Decide on a time frame and method for follow-up with the consultant based on their recommendation. I think the best piece of advice I can give here is to repeat back the plan to the consultant whenever possible.
I think that's great advice there, repeating back the plan, because there oftentimes is some degree of confusion about what exactly they want. Very, very nice advice. Any other points about the consultations?
I also wanted to talk a little bit about informal consultations, or what we commonly call curbside consults. The advice in general, avoid these because informal consultations may include substandard evaluation by the consultant and recommendations which only expose the emergency provider to more risk. Remember, only the emergency physician is at risk with curbside consultations, as informal curbside consultations fail to establish a therapeutic relationship between the consultant and the patient, thereby shielding the consultant from malpractice risk only to increase your own risk.
Yeah, I always try to tell the residents that if a consult is not written, it didn't happen. So an unwritten consult or just a phone consult is not a real consult. So whenever possible, make sure it's a real consult where they come down and see the patient, not just do it over the phone. And there's, of course, exceptions to that. If it is just a phone consultation because it's the middle of the night, then document really, really well. But it is risky to do those phone consultations. And I think your advice to avoid those whenever possible is really good advice. All right. Well, that's a great summary of the key points of this article. Now, Rupal, I know you've discussed these topics in your own lectures before. Do you have any other thoughts that go beyond this article that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Most likely, you're a pretty good communicator naturally if you decided on a career in emergency medicine. However, there are many barriers to excellent communication in the emergency department, and this includes frequent interruptions, ambient noise, and time constraints. the specific areas to focus your communication efforts in order to lower your malpractice risk includes communication with patients and their family members on their initial presentation and throughout the ED course. Remember, that initial impression that you give to the patient and their family members by introducing yourself by name, you're identifying your role in their treatment care, and setting expectations is very, very important. Also important is to remember that your patient values frequent reassessments rather than one long initial interview with the patient. Another area to focus your communication efforts is at the time of handoff. A third area to focus your communication efforts is at time of discharge, communicating with the patient both verbally and in written form the plan upon leaving the emergency department. And lastly, communication with consultants.
All right. Well, great, Rupal. Thanks so much for your time in going through this article and also some additional tips. I think these are so important and oftentimes not taught, especially to junior residents and brand new interns. And it's that time of the year where they're just starting their residencies and moving up in residency. So these are really, really useful things that'll keep you out of trouble and improve patient care and patient satisfaction. So again, Rupal, thanks for your time, and I look forward to getting you back real soon on the EMCast. Okay, well, next up on EMCast, I have a return speaker, Dr. Priya Kupusamy. Priya actually has not been on the EMCast for quite a long time. So Priya, first of all, welcome back. It's great to get you back.
Thank you.
Priya is a former resident, and she did our faculty development fellowship and chief year, and she's been working out in the community currently at Laurel Medical Center, which is, I guess, probably about 30 or 45 minutes outside of Baltimore, doing some great clinical work out in the community. She is an adjunct faculty member here at University of Maryland School of Medicine. And in the past year, preceding that, she's developed a very strong interest in risk management. And in the past year, she's created a risk management fellowship for which she is participating. So she's really getting quite involved in risk management. And we are glad to have her on board to talk about some risk management topics. This will be the first in hopefully a handful of different topics in a series of risk management topics. And we're going to start out with a topic that is really, really high risk. And it's one of those tough topics because it's something that we all learn about and we all, I think about, but maybe not quite often enough. It's one of those things that's very high risk, but it doesn't show up often enough. So this is truly one of the needles in the haystack that we've always got to be thinking about, and that is acute thoracic aortic dissection. And as we go through this, we're not going to go through the comprehensive review on this topic. We're really going to try to focus on some of the risk management issues here. And so first of all, again, welcome back, Priya. And let me first of all start out by asking you, why are we talking about this in the setting of a risk management discussion, given how rare it is?
Thank you so much, Almo. I'm really excited to be doing this podcast. And what a great question to start with. So here's what we know. We know that aortic dissection is an uncommon disease, right? It's difficult to diagnose. It has a high mortality rate and devastating complications. It's also a master mimicker of other more common diagnoses like ACS and PE. We know this. It's almost as if the disease is setting us up to fail, and plaintiff lawyers just love to hear that. So dissection is a high-risk diagnosis for litigation, especially when 1 in 6 cases get missed at the first ED visit. And the atypical presentations of this disease are overrepresented in medical malpractice cases. And these cases often involve younger patients, which brings up the point that no one is really immune.
Okay, so it sounds like we're missing this often enough that the lawyers are getting rich off this diagnosis, and that's despite the fact that we're taught a lot about this in residency. So to me, that means perhaps a lot of the stuff we've learned is wrong, and you mentioned that the atypical presentations are fairly common. So let's talk about that. So let's go ahead and start with the history. Now, I learned that the classic history is that of an elderly patient with atherosclerotic risk factors who comes in with abrupt, ripping, tearing pain from the chest, radiating straight through to the upper mid-back, the mid-scapular area, or maybe in the other direction, and it's maximum intensity at the onset, And are you going to tell me that that's not true?
Well, it's for sure true. But what you just described, Amal, is the classic presentation. So if an elderly woman with, let's say, history of hypertension presents with this sudden onset, tearing chest pain, and it radiates to the back, we would all nail the diagnosis, right? But unfortunately, patients don't always read the textbook. Well, I take that back. They may consult Dr. Google or phone a friend, but they don't always read the medical textbook and come in with this crystal clear description of their symptoms, right?
Right.
So the cases we tend to miss are the ones that present subtly, the ones that don't scream, "Hey there, I'm a dissection, come find me." These are the cases we tend to overlook and underdocument, in my opinion. So where do we begin? Let's start with the history. And I got this from a Canadian website, and I thought it was just a really good way of putting together the history on what to look for with regards to aortic dissection. So you have to ask yourself, what story is the patient trying to tell me? The story with aortic dissection is all about the S. So the S for sudden, severe, sharp, stabbing, skips as in migratory or radiating, and stuttering like intermittent, waxing and waning type of pain. So while sharp and stabbing pain tend to be more common, tearing and ripping pain is more specific for dissection. So if a patient's description of symptoms sounds vague or they're unable to localize their pain, this can actually be a worrisome feature. Another concept is chest pain plus one. I really like this one too. It's based on the idea that a tear in the aorta can devascularize any organ from head to toe, including the brain, the heart, and the kidneys. So with dissection, you'll often get chest pain plus something else like abdominal pain or leg pain in the setting of ischemic limb or neurodeficits. So the nice thing is you can always work backwards from the plus one concept. For example, if someone presents with left-sided weakness, ask them if they had chest pain before the onset of stroke symptoms. This can be really helpful.
Okay, so I like those S's. So sudden, severe, sharp, stabbing, stuttering, and the pain can skip or move around and unable to localize. So that doesn't really start with an S, so we're not going to talk about that. And also the chest pain plus something else. And that's important because whenever we think about chest pain, we talk about, I guess, the big three or the big four deadly things. We talk about ACS and PE and dissection and, I guess, pericarditis or tamponade. And of those four, the only one that really gives you chest pain plus abdominal pain or chest pain plus low back pain or chest pain plus leg pain, the only one of those four really is dissection. So I like that also, that chest pain plus something else, the chest pain plus one. What about risk factors? People make a big deal about risk factors, and I've learned that the classic presentation is atherosclerosis type of risk factors. Is that true, or are there other type of risk factors that we need to be wary of?
Yes, definitely. Keep an eye out for the presence or absence of certain risk factors that can either elevate or lower your suspicion. Atherosclerosis is certainly a risk factor. Most common tends to be hypertension. So find out if there's other things like bicuspid aortic valve, history of an aortic aneurysm, or a history of connective tissue disease such as Marfan's. Also want to ask about family history, especially if there's any family history of aortic aneurysm or dissection, or even if there's a history of a sudden cardiac death, that can be helpful as well. This all seems pretty straightforward and obvious, but the past medical history section of the chart is often carried over from previous visits. And if we don't specifically ask, I find that we may miss some valuable clues. So think of it as an extension of the HPI that you gather initially. Remember to also inquire about other risk factors such as smoking, cocaine use, pregnancy, and trauma. Just like the past medical history, the social history section is often incomplete or just outright incorrect in charts. And we're ultimately responsible for verifying this information, and specific documentation of either the presence or absence of risk factors can help support your medical decision making. How many times has someone said no to drug use in triage, but then when the physician asked them, they open up and say, actually, yes, I use cocaine and I smoked it last night. And that can be really helpful in the chest pain workup. So be sure to ask those questions yourself when you're gathering the history from the patient. This is also especially true if you decide to send the patient home without working them up for dissection, because all of that information that you gathered, the pertinent positives and the pertinent negatives, can actually justify your decision and explain why you made that decision to send them home. Most importantly, though, don't assume that a young patient can't have dissection. So all the elements that I mentioned are sources of risk in younger patients as well. No one is really immune. This is a point I really, really want to drive home. Young patients can absolutely have dissection.
Great points. Well, what about the exam? I learned, again, from the textbooks that these patients typically look uncomfortable, they're very hypertensive, they have unequal pulses, and that they can have neurodeficits. What's the truth here about their exam?
So classic exam findings are seen in less than one-third of cases. So what about the other two-thirds? Something that I kept reading about and loved is look, listen, and feel. So basically, take it back to the bedside. Look for signs of Marfan syndrome and keep in mind that patients may not know that they have it. So you have to think about it in order to pick it up. You have to ask the patient, or you have to look at the patient and pick up on clues that might give you a hint that maybe they do have Marfans and don't know it. Listen for a new aortic regurgitation murmur and feel for a pulse deficit. Pulse deficit is only noted in a small subset of patients, though. But if you happen to pick it up on exam, it's pretty specific for dissection. And the blood pressure differential is not specific.
All right. So look, listen, and feel. We're going to look for signs of Marfans or other similar connective tissue diseases. Listen for the diastolic murmur. Feel for the pulse deficits. I like that. In terms of the workup, classically, again, classically from the textbooks, we learn about the chest x-ray showing a wide mediastinum, and we learn that there's probably not much utility to the EKG, which usually just shows LVH from the longstanding history of hypertension. And in recent years, people have been talking about D-dimer testing, although it seems like there's no consensus. And then also in terms of the workup, people have talked a lot about CTA or TEE, transesophageal echo, as being the best diagnostic test. Is there anything else that we should know about the workup?
Well, I would say beware of the classics. So a normal mediastinum doesn't rule out a dissection. And there have been plenty of cases where patients had dissection in the setting of a normal D-dimer. So don't rely on D-dimer as a test of exclusion. Elevated troponin is not always ACS, right? We know this. A common presentation of missed dissection is a patient who presents with chest pain, has a normal set of troponin, maybe two sets are normal, and they're discharged home. Along the same lines, remember that not every STEMI is ACS, and not every focal neurologic deficit is CVA. What do I mean by that? So we see a STEMI or focal extremity weakness, and boom, we rush to get the patient to the cath lab or we give lytics, and this can ultimately be disastrous in the setting of dissection. So it's easy to get tunnel vision in these situations, especially when it's at the tail end of a long shift, and we're all guilty of it. So just keep those points in mind.
Okay, yeah, the EKG I've read can definitely show evidence of ischemia, and I guess it can bump your troponin also.
It can. When dissections present as a STEMI, they tend to present as an inferior STEMI, and then you could see elevated troponins in that setting as well.
Sure.
So point-of-care ultrasound can be a useful bedside tool as well to look for an intimal flap and or a pericardial effusion. So use that to your advantage, especially since bedside ultrasounds are more readily available in emergency departments. If you have a high suspicion for dissection, go ahead and bypass labs to get that CTA. And get the CTA even if the creatinine is elevated, but be sure to document your reasoning in the chart. So let's say you did just that. you bypass labs or scan the patient with an elevated creatinine because you were really worried about that patient. And they didn't end up having a dissection, but they did end up on dialysis with renal failure. Are you protected? I had the same question, so I asked around, and it seems like a situation of damned if you do and damned if you don't. Because if there's a delay in care, you may end up getting sued for not bypassing labs to get that CTA. So ultimately, I think the answer to that question is do the right thing for the patient and let them know why you're doing it as well as the risks involved. And having an informed consent form on file can't hurt. And then just wanted to mention something real quick about decision aids. In general, I think they can be very helpful for clinical support, but with aortic dissection, the current ones must be used with caution because they do come with their own limitations like subjective questions and nonspecific elements. So use the decision aids with caution.
Now, with decision aids, you're talking about things like what we often use in other diseases like the PERC score and the Wells score and the Hart score and so on. And there has been some press about different types of decision aids. Maybe some of them use a D-dimer with thoracic aortic dissection, but you're not a big fan of these decision aids, sounds like.
Right now, I can't say that I fully support it because it hasn't been validated. But if you go on to MDCalc, the ADDRS decision aid is available to use. So it's there. I would say use it with caution in the sense of know how you're using it, in what setting, which patient you're using it for, and use it only if it will support your medical decision making.
Got it. And last I recall from the ASEP clinical policy on aortic dissection, they also were not fans of decision aids, at least based on that policy, which was maybe about 2 years ago. So we'll have to see if there's any great literature and with validation. And I think you make a very good point. There's a lot of decision aids and decision instruments and rules that come out, but if they're not externally validated, then I don't think they're reliable. And certainly, I don't think anything's been externally validated for any dissection type of decision aids.
Hopeful for the future, though. Maybe we'll build that up to be stronger.
Sure. Okay, so we've talked about history, physical risk factors. We've talked about the workup. And let's now move on to the treatment. So let's say that you have a diagnosis or very strongly a presumptive diagnosis. You go ahead and you call surgery. And while you're waiting, we've all been taught you give a beta blocker to get the heart rate down to this magical number of 60. And then you give some type of blood pressure medicine and afterload reducer to get the systolic blood pressure down to the magical number of 100 or maybe 110 or so. Is at least that still true, or is that wrong also?
The answer to your question is yes, but with some caveats. There's some critical steps involved in diagnosing and managing a patient with dissection. First and foremost, if you have a high clinical suspicion, don't wait for imaging results to start heart rate and blood pressure control. You'll be legally protected as long as you clearly document your thought process. You want to rapidly reduce the heart rate and blood pressure in that order. So that's really important. You want to rapidly reduce the heart rate and blood pressure in that order. Heart rate first and then blood pressure in order to prevent the reflex tachycardia. Don't forget to add pain medications, which can help bring down that heart rate and blood pressure as well. And once you have the diagnosis, of course, get prompt surgical consultation regardless of the type of dissection. Also, it's been stated several times in the literature that for every hour delay in diagnosis, there's a 1 to 2% mortality. The plaintiff attorney will want to use the phrase, time is muscle, against you. So it's important to document critical steps in your timeline, such as when you ordered imaging, when you initiated the heart rate and blood pressure control, and called for a consult or transfer.
All right. Well, that was a great discussion on the risk management, I guess, pearls and pitfalls with thoracic aortic dissection. Can you just wrap things up, maybe by summarizing what you think are the 3 to 5 biggest pitfalls that people make that lead specifically to litigation in what you've seen?
Yeah, sure. One of the biggest pitfalls is lack of documentation to support your medical decision making. I think this is a big one. Remember that you can document a lot of inferred medical decision making just within your HPI and exam. For example, stating that chest pain is gradual onset with no radiation towards the back, equal pulses bilaterally, and no diastolic murmur will serve to support your clinical decision making without needing to repeat those same statements in a separate area of the chart. So this actually allows you to be more efficient and it saves you some time. And let's be real, I know how much we all just love charting. And then documenting key pertinent negatives, so not just positives in the chart, shows that you were thinking about the diagnosis. And whenever this can be shown, there's more ammunition for the defense attorney to back you up. So for example, even if you're 100% sure of a diagnosis, still document pertinent negatives that point you away from other diagnoses. This will save you if you end up being wrong. And so bottom line is, when it comes to risk management, no one is telling you to work up every chest pain patient for dissection. I am not telling you to do that. But you have to consider it in your differential. You have to ask yourself what you would want your chart to look like if your patient went home and died of an aortic dissection. It's okay if you don't think a workup is warranted. That's completely fine as long as you document your reasons. The chart tells all. And if you can't come up with a reason, then you may need to reconsider your plan. And then finally, if you remember nothing else from this podcast, please, please take home this one point that young patients can absolutely have dissection. I really, really want to drive that point home with this podcast. These cases with young patients having dissections are out there and we're seeing it. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've seen a few cases, med mal cases involving aortic dissection, and invariably, at least what we see in the med mal arena is relatively young people in their 30s or 40s, who do have some risk factors, but not the kind of risk factors that knock your socks off. And they come in with atypical presentations. And if it's not in your differential, you're not going to think of it and work it up. You're certainly not going to be documenting that you thought of it. So the age myth that we've all been taught really does lead to a lot of problems. So, all right, Priya, well, thanks so much for going through this topic. It is a very important topic. It's not a common disease that we see, but unfortunately, it is one of those diseases that tends to be deadly in young people, and that combination oftentimes does lead to litigation because it's such a shocking thing to happen and a surprise. And we always say that bad outcomes are not what make for lawsuits. It's surprising bad outcomes that make for lawsuits. Mm-hmm. So, well, thanks, Priya. I look forward to getting you back on the EMcast to talk about some more good risk management things and also some tips about how to stay out of trouble.
Thank you so much for inviting me to do this podcast. I had a lot of fun.
All right. Well, it's time for our wrap-up summary. As you recall, we started things off with a discussion of women and acute coronary syndrome. Just a reminder, heart disease still remains the number one killer of women in the United States. Now, very appropriately, a lot of focus and a lot of concern in the media is really focused on breast cancer and other types of cancer, but it is so important to remember, for all of us physicians and also for our patients, that heart disease is still the number one killer of women. In fact, I recall reading that if you combine cardiocerebral disease and death due to cardiocerebral disease, it accounts for more death in first world countries than all types of cancer combined. And yet people oftentimes forget that women are still at high risk for coronary artery disease and also cerebrovascular disease. There are physiologic differences that we went through which account for differences in the coronary anatomy for women. Women have smaller diameter coronary vessels. And one of the problems that we encounter is that because of this, when women have MIs, they don't mount the same magnitude of ST segment elevation, so they're more likely to be diagnosed as non-STEMIs or misdiagnosed as just having non-specific EKG findings. Your computer is going to be more likely to call it non-specific as well.
their troponins often tend to not be as high either. They will still bump their troponin if they're infarcting their cells, but it may not be quite as high, may certainly not be as dramatic. Women have higher baseline myocardial flow, and that produces increased shear stress and increase in plaque instability. And part of that results in the reason that women more often have these clean cardiac catheterizations, because oftentimes their MIs are more often due to plaque erosion. So non-occlusive ACS is more common in women, often due to that plaque erosion rather than the traditional ruptured plaque and thrombus formation and platelet aggregation, the typical mechanism that we have learned about for men. There's a couple of other causes of non-occlusive ACS that occur in women more commonly, including the Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, that's that stressed cardiomyopathy, and also spontaneous coronary artery dissection, which we've talked about a couple of times in recent years. It's really important that we maintain a higher index of suspicion for women having ACS, even if they've had a relatively clean cath recently, because they don't always have the plaques that lead to the MI. They can just have MIs due to the plaque erosion or endothelial damage that's caused by erosion. There are some non-traditional risk factors for ACS in women to be aware of, including stress, and also women that are postmenopausal. Even though they may be relatively young, 45, 50 years old, if they're postmenopausal, they can be at higher risk of having acute coronary syndrome. Pregnant patients are also at higher risk for developing acute coronary syndrome. It's certainly not something that we typically think about. Pregnant women usually are relatively young. They're usually pretty healthy. And yet they do have a slight increased incidence of having acute coronary syndrome, myocardial infarction, and the spontaneous coronary artery dissection. And there are certain conditions during pregnancy that can predict future risk. Preeclampsia is a risk factor for future ACS abruption. Also gestational diabetes, gestational hypertension. Now, you know, let's not go crazy about this. Overall, the risk is still relatively low. We're not admitting and ruling out every pregnant patient that presents to the emergency department, but at the very least, you've got to think about it. You've got, when they have chest pain, you've got to think about it and at least check that 12-lead ECG. And it, when you see abnormalities, don't blow it off, because these patients are at increased risk. In terms of presentations, women tend to present atypically more often. We've talked about that many times before. And what is the most common anginal equivalent? In other words, when they don't have chest pain, what alternative symptom do they most frequently have? Shortness of breath, just like in diabetics and just like in the elderly. Shortness of breath is the most common anginal equivalent in patients that are not having chest pain. Fortunately, chest pain is still the most common presentation, but if they don't have chest pain, they come in with shortness of breath and they don't have obvious wheezing or some clear-cut pulmonary cause. At least, again, at least check that 12-lead EKG. The heart score is something that can be used in women despite the atypical presentation. The studies in which heart score was used turn out to be pretty good. The heart score is still something that we use, but you may consider lowering your bar for that H part of the score, because atypical presentations are common. And also you may consider adding those non-traditional risk factors to the R score in the heart score. And also remember, women should be getting all of the evidence-based therapies that men get, including aspirin and beta blockers and heparin and whatever it is that you normally do for men who you are diagnosing ACS in. You should probably do the same thing for women. And that may go without saying, but it should be said anyway, because all the studies say that women do not get the same evidence-based therapies that men do. For some reason, we tend to not treat them as aggressively as men. All right. Enough about ACS in women. Next topic we addressed was risk management through communication and documentation. Rupal Jain came back to give us that discussion, and there was a lot of content in this discussion. One of the things she talked about was four different purposes of documentation. Number one, communication of clinical data to downstream providers. That's obvious. Number two, supporting reimbursement. We don't like to talk about that, but that's pretty obvious also. Number three, ensuring compliance with hospital and regulatory policies. We hate addressing that, but it's true. And then number four, the other thing that we hate to admit, is that good documentation is intended to shield us from malpractice risk. So there's a lot of reasons why you really need to focus on good documentation. And then communication is very important as well. Ask your patient if they have any questions. Give them an opportunity to ask questions before you rapidly walk out of the room. And also shared decision-making can be very, very helpful for these patients. Rupal talked about disclosing errors. It's definitely something that a lot of us are a bit uncomfortable about. We've been trained our entire lives as physicians that we're supposed to be perfect. We're not supposed to make errors. And so it's very difficult to admit when an error is made. But studies seem to indicate, generally speaking, that the risk of malpractice is significantly reduced. And also, patient satisfaction is improved when we're honest with them and we disclose what errors they are. You may need to do this in conjunction with your risk managers. And also, as Rupal suggested, admitting errors and also apologies can vary from state to state in terms of whether and how they should be done. So talk to your risk managers about that. In terms of disclosing errors, there's a method to it. Number one, inform the patient or family before they discover it on their own. And two, explicitly state that an error has occurred. Three, describe the error in clear and concise manner. Four, explain any potential harms, even if unlikely. Five, express regret without admitting fault necessarily. And number six, explain what steps you're going to do to try to prevent it from recurring. And the majority of studies say that the patients really do appreciate this. Rupal talked about handoffs and transitions of care. Handoffs are definitely the most dangerous time of an emergency department visit, when one practitioner is handing care off to someone else and then leaving. In fact, Rupal cited a study indicating that about 24% of malpractice claims turned on the basis of breakdowns in the handoffs. She emphasized the importance of if-then statements in the handoffs. Try to minimize interruptions. And I mentioned that one of the things that we've done at University of Maryland is we do walk rounds. We do walking sign-out rounds. So we'll actually go from room to room as we discuss the patient. And that really does decrease the number of interruptions because everybody knows you're signing out. They try to back off on all but the most important interruptions. And also has the benefit of giving you an opportunity to just take a quick glance at the patient that you're going to be assuming care of. And sometimes you find out that there's something going on with the patient that you didn't know about purely based on the sign up. Don't leave any ambiguity in the transitions. And also, Rupal had a point that once you sign out, get out, leave the emergency department. And that way everybody knows that the new person's in charge of the patient. Because if you're still there and the new person who's taking your sign out are both still there, oftentimes there's a bit of conflict or uncertainty about who's managing the patient and when questions comes up. And when questions come up, people may be a little bit uncertain about who to ask. And one person may start writing new orders on and the other person doesn't know about it. So sign out and then get out. Finally, she talked a bit about discharge and follow-up. And it's always a good idea to go and talk to the patient. Don't just give them written discharge instructions, but talking to the patient is so important. It also gives you one final chance to see if they have any questions. And talking to the patient really strongly emphasizes the importance of those written discharge instructions that they are about to get. Don't use medical jargon. They typically say make your written instructions and probably your verbal instructions also at about a fifth grade reading level. In terms of consultations, she cited literature saying that one third of malpractice claims turn on the basis of consultation issues. So again, be very careful about those consultations. Make sure that whatever you're asking your consultant is very clear and stay away from those informal or curbside consultations. Again, I always say that if the consult is not written, it didn't happen. So just those phone consults are not very protective at all. If you want to get some good advice from your consultant, have them come down and see the patient. Now, that's not always practical. And so if you are just going to be talking to them on the phone, make sure that you document very carefully what was said. In fact, in our emergency department, we actually tape record the conversations on the phone line. And anyone who's calling in gets a little message before they actually talk to us. They get a little message saying, we are going to be tape recording this phone call. And that can be very helpful as well. Moving on, the last topic we addressed was thoracic aortic dissection and some of the risk management issues. Again, this is one of the classic needles in the haystack. We don't see dissections that often, but it's one of those diagnoses that you've always got to be thinking about, always have to be on the lookout for, because if you miss this, the patient has a high chance, high likelihood of being dead. And so even though it's not common, it's one of those can't miss diagnoses. And I say that despite knowing that oftentimes it is missed. It really is one of the most difficult diagnoses to pick up because it does not at all present like they do in the textbooks, and it can present in so many different ways. There are some pearls that you can use. Priya talked about the six S's in terms of the character of pain. Sudden, severe, sharp, stabbing. It skips, meaning it can migrate or radiate, and it can stutter, meaning the pain can come and go or wax and wane. She also talked about another concept that I've heard a lot of other speakers mention, chest pain plus neurologic symptoms, chest pain plus leg weakness, chest pain plus low back pain, chest pain plus abdominal pain, chest pain plus a new diastolic murmur, chest pain plus a new bump in creatinine or a dead kidney. You know, chest pain plus one or two other things going on. Well, one of the things you've got to think about is aortic dissection. Make sure you know about the risk factors for dissection. They tend to be cardiac in nature, hypertension being the most common. And don't forget that young people can have dissections too, especially chronically hypertensive or poorly controlled hypertensive young people, patients that are using cocaine, and also young people that have Marfan's or other connective tissue disorders. And one additional point is that women in their third trimester of pregnancy are in a very hyperdynamic state, and they are at slightly increased risk for having dissection as well. It's a hyperdynamic state that puts them at risk. Other physical exam findings, new aortic insufficiency, murmur, pulse deficits, those are very important to comment on. They're not always there, but it's important to comment on just to let everyone know you thought about it. In terms of your diagnostic workup, there is the aortic dissection risk score, which is a clinical decision aid, which is pending validation. It's not necessarily ready for prime time, or if you're going to use it, it's not perfect. And there's additional scores that incorporate the D-dimer, but they still are not perfect either. If you're going to work these patients up, go for the CT angiogram. Aortogram is out. CT angiogram, which is much more widely available, is appropriate and is probably the diagnostic test of choice now. When you are managing these patients with confirmed or even suspected dissection, focus on the heart rate first, then focus on the heart rate, and then after that, focus on the heart rate, and then after that, then focus on the blood pressure. So hopefully you get the point. Heart rate comes first. Get them on medications that lowers that heart rate, that pounding shear force against the aorta. Get the heart rate down to about the 60s. That's a general, non-evidence-based, but it's a general recommendation. Get the heart rate down to the 60s, and then try to get a systolic blood pressure after that down to maybe about 100, 110 or so, the low hundreds for sure. And once you make the diagnosis, then you want to get your vascular or your cardiothoracic surgeons involved immediately and make absolutely sure that you're documenting the times of interventions and also the times of your consultations if, God forbid, there is a bad outcome and people start looking back at your chart. All right, folks. Well, I think that's about it for the October issue of EMedHome's EMCast. My thanks once again to the brilliant women who spoke this month, Susie DeMeester, Rupal Jain, and Priya Kupusamy. I hope to get all three of them back again in the near future for some more discussions. And I hope everybody out there is staying safe, washing your hands, wearing your masks, and hopefully we'll be getting a vaccine soon for that COVID-19. Until then, please stay safe and take care of each other. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks for listening to EMCAST. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.